I have outlined my view that socialism, liberalism, and conservatism each have a truth at their core, and that successful societies represent a more or less balanced amalgam of these philosophical ideas and the policies they give rise to. Different societies represent different amalgams of each. Some place more emphasis on liberal or socialist or conservative inclinations, but no successful society is of one pure orientation. How terrible would a purely liberal society be without the consolations of conservatism or the moral sentiment of redistribution? While most of us identify with one or more of the orientations as a matter of emphasis, in our cups we could hardly deny the importance of the other orientations in making a cosmopolitan society. However, it is a tendency of people to take their preferred orientation and insist upon it as an all-dominating philosophy and policy for society. This is where ideology comes in. Adolf Reed has a good definition. Ideology is the mechanism that harmonizes the principles that you want to believe with what advances your material interest. This is the difference between conservatism and neoconservatism, liberalism and neoliberalism, socialism and neo-socialism. New versions of old truths have mutated and now have their own hyper-partisan rationality. It is the distinction between Adam Smith's classical liberalism and Ayn Rand's extreme libertarianism. First, there was the turn to neoconservatism, arising during the Cold War, led by Jewish intellectuals originally from the left, who took up the fight against communism. Neoconservatives became ascendant during George W. Bush's presidency. Francis Fukuyama subsequently pointed out the contradiction in neoconservatives such as Paul Wolfowitz, urging the theology of regime change under Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. But there is no gainsaying that the neoconservatives were on the right side of history in the earlier fight against communism. The leading Australian exemplar was Robert Mann, as his 2005 book, Left, Right, Left, describes. He was a leftist who swung right in his stand against communism and then backed to his original left-of-centre orientation after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. He was nothing if not the most principled of the anti-communists. In stark contrast to the ideological trajectory of Keith Windschuttle, whose comparable book might have been titled From Pro-Communist Left to Anti-Aboriginal Right, Australian conservatives disgraced their movement when they embraced Windschuttle's ideological pedigree and shunned man. It is not anti-communism that is the credential here for me, but rather the squalid way in which Windschuttle was allowed to parlay his anti-Aboriginal history into a late-life conservative sinecure. Then there was a turn to neoliberalism, which is the subject of this revanche. Now we may have a second version of a turn to neo-socialism. A decade after the Great Recession, the crises of the neoliberal order have led to a loss of faith in capitalism. Movements of the young are openly cynical about capitalism, searching for another social and economic system that remains undefined. In the absence of a definition of the better system, they only know that capitalism and markets have had their day and can no longer be trusted. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal are the vanguard of such movements. This is the neo-socialist turn. Before we make the neo-socialist turn, we should perhaps consider that the case for liberal capitalism may be different from the case for neoliberalism. Maybe we could reboot the moral case for capitalism when we rid it of its neoliberal excesses and reform the metastasizing disease of finance capitalism in a way that Obama failed to do in the aftermath of the GFC. The neo-socialists might consider that equality is not an economic system, but a preference. It is a set of public policy choices, and ultimately should be the expression of the democracy. Neoliberalism has insinuated itself into every corner of contemporary life and society. In the midst of the GFC, journalist Matt Taibbi gave us the eternal metaphor of Goldman Sachs as, quote, a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. No social, cultural, family, or personal relationship problem or opportunity is free from the relentless search for monetization. Entire societies have caught this virus, which leaves little independent space for love, generosity, and care without someone searching for an angle. We literally have financial devices to clean grandma out of her house and home. This is the mutation of Adam Smith's self-interest or self-regard into profit motive and greed. I've long been a defender of the liberal power of self-interest within Smith's meaning. I consider it to be a natural motivation and a driver of progress, balanced with the moral sentiment of other regard. The liberal engine of self-interest makes for a good society. I have no objection to markets where price properly reflects value. The problem with markets arises when we exploit nature as if it were a free good, and as if pollution and loss can be prevented by market mechanisms rather than law. Markets are an efficient price mechanism, but their application, as broad as it may be, has limits. I strongly resist the class prejudice from the advantaged left to the effect that poor people should abjure material prosperity and self-regard. This double standard from the advantaged left is deleterious to the interest of the lower classes and highly hypocritical. I don't retreat from my defense of self-interest on the part of poor people. It is a necessary animator of social progress. What I have in mind about the correctness of Smith's self-regard is, however, different from the relentless and all-consuming pursuit of profit that neoliberalism has unleashed. Is there nothing that cannot be monetized? Consider these scenes. State services have been turned over to the private sector. A combination of not-for-profit and for-profit organizations that has created entire industries servicing social problems. The services supposedly supporting individuals and communities actually maintain the problems that give rise to them. Who wants to work themselves out of a job and out of profit? In the past 2 decades, we have seen the calamitous growth in out-of-home care, the removal by the state of at-risk children from their families, and the money spent on it by governments. All of this pain is lucrative business for privately owned companies, as well as for a plethora of religious organizations and charities, such as Anglicare, Catholic Social Services, Uniting Care, Mission Australia, and the Smith family. They have made an industry out of family dysfunction and child removal. This is the case across all areas of social services. The profit motive drives the design of these services rather than social change that will decrease the human suffering that is the income source of this business model. Former bureaucrats and politicians have inveigled themselves into these industries. They exploit their connections with government just as the big players like Goldman Sachs do. The promise of future employment in these outsourced industries influences the tendering and procurement processes supervised by the bureaucrats. A second scene concerns the administration of justice. So many functions of regulatory and quasi-judicial investigation, such as alleged misconduct of public officials and the operation of official corruption bodies, are farmed out to the private sector. Law firms and accounting firms are routinely undertaking functions on behalf of government regulatory bodies, supervising potentially corrupt and criminal behavior. It is not only conflicts of interest that are at risk. Private firms undertaking work for government have a clear incentive not to bite the hand that feeds them. Whereas public servants and public regulatory agencies are expected to be disinterested, outsourcing the functions of the Crown Solicitor and the Crime and Corruption Commission to private firms means that the necessary public disinterest is compromised. Former Crown Solicitors leave public service and take their files to private practice. But in the neoliberal period, who is going to complain? Who is going to raise questions about conflicts of interest and the absence of disinterest? Why would the legal and accounting professions consider this a corruption of the separation of powers and functions when outsourcing is so lucrative? The third scene concerns the peddling of influence. Before the neoliberal period, there was a bright line between business and labor. Politicians and office holders of the left did not carry water for business. They were aligned with unions and the social sector. It was the liberals and conservatives that were close to business. Now the lines have been completely erased. It is no surprise to find people associated with the left of the political divide working with and for business. It quickly became respectable for influential figures of the left to sell their services to the private sector. This development might be unobjectionable in principle, but one of its effects is that the counterparty surveillance that each side used to exercise over the conduct of the other in their relations with business is gone. Everyone with influence in the neoliberal period is available to work for business. The second thing that happened was that everyone with influence, whether from politics, the bureaucracy, or the offices of political parties, hung out their shingle. The peddling of influence marks the neoliberal age, with the monetization of proximity to power and the debasement of democracy. no conflict of interest, and brazen exploitation of access and influence is beyond profiteering. When governments change power, behind the parliamentary representatives is an entire ecosystem comprising thousands of people who take the spoils and peddle influence under only the nominal control of elected representatives. Power is not simply the democratically elected politicians, but an entirely opaque shadow network that feeds off access to power. Then there are the lobbyists, individuals and firms, who straddle the political divide in a way that means their influence does not wax and wane with a change of government. Get yourself partners from the other side of politics, and you have influence whichever side is in power. The fourth scene is the Future Fund. Australia's sovereign wealth fund is currently worth $178.6 billion. Originally accumulated from the proceeds of the privatisation of Telstra and other public outlays, but for what specific purpose? What did the elites in Treasury advise the federal government should be the purpose of this accumulation of public wealth? Answer: to cover the future superannuation liabilities of public officials such as themselves. Only in the neoliberal period could such a scene play out with no democratic complaint or question. Are the superannuation entitlements of the public service elite far beyond the expectations of ordinary workers relying on the universal compulsory scheme really Australia's most pressing liability? And ought public assets owned by all Australians be set aside for one group who would serve themselves first from future government outlays? The sheer self-interest of this policy is only exceeded by its dreariness, and not word of protest from the rest of us. 1,000 such scenes play out every day, making disinterested public service and ethical constraint on profit-seeking a mere legend of the past. In the neoliberal period, the separation of functions and powers is blurred, conflicts are normalised, and mutual interest in turning a blind eye or failing to ask a question is de rigueur. When I originally read John Ralston's Saul, I did not fully appreciate what he meant by distinguishing the proper mechanism of capitalism, investment and reinvestment of capital, that enables the production and employment that is the purpose of capitalistic endeavour, from the profit motive. He argued that profits are incidental to the process of production, not their principal and overriding motive, as the neoliberal ideologues would have it. Decades later, I now understand clearly Saul's distinction between the profit motive and productive capitalism. How could any of the profit-seeking scenes described above truly be called capitalism? I asked whether anyone believes the latest resistance to the race-class fusion in America by Black Lives Matter can finally defeat this 400-year-old zombie. The movement's framing of the problem as a matter of criminology and defunding the police and so on is not promising. There is a layer of the policing and justice system that needs to be confronted, but this is just the surface. And yes, racism is the layer below. But the layer sitting underneath it all is social and economic inequality. It is inequality that must be confronted and equality that must be achieved. The race reductionism of BLM's analysis of the problem cruels its policy response. It is equality of opportunity, not outcome, that must be secured. Many on the left will object that this has always been the rhetoric of the liberal society, and it hasn't led to greater equality, and we now need to talk about equality of outcomes, equity. My view is that equity is the measure and equality is the means. The achievement of equity requires equality of opportunity with personal empowerment and agency. We need to be more aggressive and unrelenting in demanding equality of opportunity and ensuring that social and economic provisioning by our government gives equality to all who stand in need. In the past, we have allowed the rhetoric of equal opportunity to flourish without actually holding government to account to ensure everyone has equality of opportunity. This essay has pointed out the unequal employment policies applied to the lowest class in Australia. The same applies to school education. These same poor people receive the worst school education. And across the range of social and economic opportunities, disadvantaged Australians don't have the same chances as other Australians. But we've also failed to realise there is another part of the equity equation, personal agency and responsibility. In Cape York, we say opportunity plus responsibility equals capability. This is how we convert equality of opportunity to equity of outcomes. It is an iterative process that takes time to work out, but is the only way individual and social progress happens. We can have a surfeit of agency and responsibility, which without opportunity will also not yield progress. We need both equality of opportunity and the necessary individual and social responsibility. Policy needs to be colorblind and class conscious. Conscious to ensure that lower class people have equality of opportunity with the rest of society. This was clearly enunciated by the American civil rights leaders under Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 3 years before his death, following the achievement of civil rights legislation by Congress. Together with Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, King published the Freedom Budget, which called for social and economic equality for all Americans, regardless of race. In his foreword to the Freedom Budget, King wrote, "After many years of intense struggle in the courts, in legislative halls, and on the streets, we have achieved a number of important victories. We have come far in our quest for respect and dignity, but we have far to go. The long journey ahead requires that we emphasize the needs of all America's poor, for there is no way merely to find work or adequate housing or quality integrated schools for Negroes alone. We shall eliminate slums for Negroes when we destroy ghettos and build new cities for all. We shall eliminate unemployment for Negroes when we demand full and fair employment for all. We shall produce an educated and skilled Negro mass when we achieve a 20th century educational system for all. This human rights emphasis is an integral part of the Freedom Budget and sets, I believe, a new and creative tone for the great challenge we yet face. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference fully endorses the Freedom Budget and plans to expend great energy and time in working for its implementation. It is not enough to project the Freedom Budget. We must dedicate ourselves to the legislative task to see that it is immediately and fully achieved. I pledge myself to this task and will urge all others to do likewise. The freedom budget is essential if the Negro people are to make further progress. It is essential if we are to maintain social peace. It is a political necessity. It is a moral commitment to the fundamental principles on which this nation was founded. Universal programs must be the first policy. African Americans, Australian Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders, and lower class people generally will benefit from universal programs. Targeted programs must be aimed at need, not race or identity. This will mean that programs targeted at Indigenous disadvantage will need to be replaced by programs aimed at all disadvantage. This will not penalize Indigenous people, as their needs will be the basis for program entitlement. There will be a place for affirmative action programs. These need to be premised on the basis of need rather than race or identity. Indeed, affirmative action on need will ensure that the lower classes have greater access to opportunities enjoyed by the mainstream. Affirmative action has proven to work in providing access and opportunity to groups that have not had the same opportunities historically. Participation gaps have been narrowed and sometimes closed through affirmative action. The downside of affirmative action, resentment, and accusations of reverse discrimination will be eradicated with need-based affirmative action. African American and Australian Indigenous people will be wary of replacing race-based programs with need-based programs. Discrimination in access to and enjoyment of universal programs in the past is fresh in the memories of these communities. Racism is an ever-present risk, and its insinuation into government program service delivery is not just an accusation about systemic racism, it is real. I have been a witness long enough to how it plays out in real life. However, as long as effective protections against discrimination are put in place, the benefits of moving from race-based policies and programs to need-based policies and programs will far outweigh these risks. It will produce better policy as well, because it will have to focus on socio-economic advancement rather than being diverted by race and identity ephemera.